Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 6, 1996. In the Creekside Room this evening, our speaker is Mark Schwinn. Today he will be concluding his two-part series on the poems of Robert Frost. Today's session number is 2 and is titled, Picking Apples at the End of the World. More Frost. Let's listen in.
My name is Mark Schwinn. And I teach at Valparaiso University in Valparaiso, Indiana, in the Honors College called Christ College, where I also have been serving for the last 6 years as dean. Teach humanities there. And this is the second day, as I just said, of a two-day series on Robert Frost and his poetry. Yesterday, we spent almost the entire session talking about one of Frost's poems, probably the best known of his poems, which I'll flash up here just for a moment. And I indicated that today we would spend the majority of our time together talking about some of Frost's sonnets. But I thought that by way of introducing to those who are here for the first time, a little bit of Frost, and for those who are here to kind of review and recapitulate what we did the last time, I thought I would say a little about this poem, just kind of reviewing some of the things we said about it yesterday, and then telling you about some of the questions which I've had addressed to me by some of the folks who were here yesterday, and I promised I would start today by trying to answer some of those. And also share with you some of the interesting coincidences that always happen at Holden, namely coincidences between the kinds of things we talked about here in connection with interpreting the Frost poem and the kinds of things other groups talked about in very different settings and about very different subjects. And I'll share some of those happy coincidences and confluences of theme and attention after I summarize some of the things we talked about yesterday. So if you'll just bear with me for a second. We spent the first part of the hour yesterday talking about why the poem is so often misread, and I won't go into that. I'll just begin to review some of the things we noticed about it. We really, I think, started to take off into what the poem is doing when we noticed that it had two parts, one running three stanzas, beginning two roads diverged, and one running three lines, also beginning two roads diverged. And then we took these two lines here to be transitional. So we spent a lot of time together attempting to compare and contrast these two very different stories. They look like they begin the same way. Two roads diverged in a wood. Here, two roads diverged in a yellow wood. And we called forth a number of the contrasts. And just to mention a few of them, there seemed to be a definite tone of certainty and decisiveness here. Two roads diverged in a wood. I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Here, the speaker is quite certain that one road was less traveled than another. We spent a lot of time showing that this speaker is not at all certain about whether one road is less traveled than the other. And so here we found a kind of tentativeness. Here we found a kind of certainty. Here we found, obviously, a kind of brevity and lack of detail. Here, a kind of long narrative relative to this one, indicating a kind of ambiguity and ambivalence and equivocation. We then spent another 15 minutes trying to draw out what kind of speaker this person is. And this one seemed, we had a long conversation about at what point in this narrative does the speaker actually take one path rather than another, with I think about half the group believing that this took here is like this took, meaning that it's an action, active verb of choice, took meaning walk down. about the other half of the group thought that this took really belongs with this as, then took the other as just as fair, that is just as fair as the first half. So the took as here then turns into a verb of appraisal or interpretation, and the decision then isn't made until here, where it's made, interestingly, in the form of a decision to keep the first one, not to take the second one. So we really began to see that in all kinds of ways, the contrast between this speaker and this speaker were quite pronounced. But of course, this speaker are the same speaker. What's the difference? Well, this is the story that the speaker will be telling ages and ages hence. This is the story he's telling about the past, we would guess relatively recent past. So in any event, we have a speaker here who has enough self-awareness, we discovered, to recognize that the shape of his own stories about himself are going to be different depending, among other things, on how old he or she is. Where in his or her life's journey is this person? And then we begin to talk about the interesting temporal context here, that it takes place in the autumn, the yellow wood, the paths with leaves on them, but it also takes place, this first narrative, in the morning, in both that morning equally way. And so we talk for a while about the contrast between this person's morning consciousness, oh, I kept the first for another day. I mean, after all, I'm 20 or 25 and immortal. I can keep it and come back and take it at some later time. And the sort of autumn consciousness, which prevails here, I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. We even had an interesting argument about whether the road not taken in the title referred to the road the speaker didn't take, or to the road the speaker did take, because in this narrative he said it was relatively less taken or less traveled, and began to see, I think some of you argued, well, it actually refers to both paths. Narrative A emphasizes I kept the first, the road he didn't take. Narrative B emphasizes the road he did take, and so, but because it was not taken, less traveled, and so we had fun with that. Finally, we talked about the sense in which the poem, by constantly forcing us, and we constantly found ourselves forced to think in doublets, two narratives, two different tones here, two different ways of reading the verb took, and a lot at stake depending upon how we read it. Does it belong with the as or not? There was quite a lot of argument. This group got very, very picky about the poem. So when people listen to the tape, they'll be shocked to discover that 30 Holden Villagers spent 10 minutes talking about a comma. But we didn't want to leave any stone unturned here in these paths. And we noticed that the poem forces us into making these choices ourselves, and therefore to kind of reenact, as we attempt to read the poem, what the speaker went through as he attempted to read these paths and to make decisions about them. We learned ourselves how way leads on to way. We learned ourselves how if we make a choice here that took means one thing, it commits us to further choices down the way. And we constantly found ourselves wanting sometimes to say, well, it means both, but having to make choices. And we saw how those choices and interpretation mirrored, in a way, this person's choices. That, I think, captures at least some of the more salient points that we raised and talked about. And what I want to do first is to show you some of the rather astonishing, I think, coincidences that are going on here. Ann Peterson, who's teaching next door and who's a theologian, has been using this book in one of her sessions last week, Norman MacLean's Young Men in Fire, a terrific book. And the book is about a fire that took place in Montana in 1949, killing a number of young men who were smoke jumpers. And the book is not just a book about that episode, but about the larger story of MacLean's effort to find out the story and to give it shape. And I just want to read you one of the paragraphs in there and see if you can hear the echoes of what McLean is doing here and what she did with this book in her session and what we did with The Road Not Taken. Here is what McLean says. If there is a story in Man Gulch, it will take something of a storyteller at this date to find it. And it is not easy to imagine what impulses would lead him to search for it. He probably should be an old storyteller, at least old enough to know that the problem of identity is always a problem, not just a problem of youth, and even old enough to know that the nearest anyone can come to finding himself at any given age is to find a story that somehow tells him about himself. Okay? Now, here's a speaker who tells two different stories about the same thing at two different ages. The age at which he's writing the narrative and then imagining what he'll be telling ages and ages hence. And it's about a choice in his life. And he gives that choice very different shape depending upon how he shapes those narratives. And here's McLean again. I'll repeat his last sentence. To be even old enough to know that the nearest anyone can come to finding himself at any given age is to find a story that somehow tells him about himself. And what we saw, I think, yesterday in this poem was that, in a way, this speaker is a very different character in his mourning phase of his life than he will be, and he's able to imagine what he will be like, at the autumn phase. And the narratives, of course, as we drew out the contrasts, show how part of his way of maintaining identity over time is to reshape the stories he tells himself about himself to himself. And how we all do that. I mean, I think it's important for us to recognize that probably this month you've been asked by somebody to explain how you came to live in this town or do this job or what it was like to raise six children or how it was that such and such a thing happened, and you found yourself falling into story. And if you're honest enough about it, you probably realize that that story you told about something that happened when you were in eighth grade or when you were in high school or when you were in college or when you didn't go to college has taken on a different character and shape over the years. My parents, for example, told the story over and over about what it was like to be in the Depression. And that story changed, I could tell, even as a child, depending upon how many things we wanted. We heard that they even lacked even more things than they had lacked the last time that they told the story. So that by the time we heard the story the sixth time, it seemed as though they were kind of living out of doors the entire time. My point is that there's something deeply wise about the fact that that's a very human thing to do, and probably even a necessary thing to do for us to maintain the thread of identity. Another thing that happened by coincidence, Christine Carlson, who was doing Bible study, did the Gospel of Mark, and she spent an entire session talking about the beginnings of Mark's Gospel and how, unlike Luke and Matthew, which begin with nativity narratives, Mark begins with Jesus' baptism. And she, in the course of making those remarks, said this exact quote. I wrote it down very hurriedly. The way we tell a story can make all the difference in the world for us. The way we tell a story can make all the difference in the world for us. I think that was not a conscious or even unconscious echo of the poem. But again, what she was trying to draw out was the importance of how that narrative is shaped to get to the identity of who Jesus is. In other words, Jesus' identity in Mark, something he learns at his baptism when the heavens open up and he sees and hears something, and it's and a kind of identity that he, throughout much of that gospel, keeps secret. The readers of the gospel, of Mark's gospel, are given clues to Jesus' identity by how the story begins and how it ends, how it's shaped. So that was another area in the village where the importance of narrative came up. And finally, one of the villagers who attended the session the last time is a professor at San Diego and teaches psychology. And she and I had a long talk after Vespers about how more and more psychologists are attending to the stories that those that they work with tell them. I once worked with a psychologist, and we used this poem when I was teaching at the University of Chicago, and his whole theory of not only psychoanalytic treatment, but a lot of other therapeutic treatments is that what the therapist and the person who was there needing therapy were doing was a long process of trying to agree to a story of a person's life that this person could live with. Getting a story straight that had therapeutic value so that they could emerge with a more whole and more healed identity. So that stories that we tell about ourselves to ourselves may be oftentimes a source of great sickness or a source of great health. And so that's another whole context, mental health or the psyche in which telling stories to ourselves about ourselves is critical. Now, someone asked me, and here's the transition into today's work. Someone said to me yesterday, I think it was immediately after class, now, I thought this was very interesting what we did, but do you really think that Frost put all those things in there? I mean, did we really, as we came out with our own reading of this poem, did we kind of recapitulate Frost's own process of writing the poem? Duplicate exactly what he intended to do in our assessment of what the poem says. And I said I would speak a little bit about that before introducing some new poems. Frost wrote actually quite a bit, more than a lot of poets, about his own practice as a writer. And I think he'd be the first to say that there's no general way all poets work. He talked about the way he worked. One of the things he said was he didn't think that readers of his poetry could be surprised and delighted by his poems if he wasn't himself surprised and delighted by them as he was writing them. And that means that Frost often set out on paths of creativity, not knowing ahead of time where the whole enterprise would lead him. And often, he would be the first to say, building better than he knew. That is, in the course of struggling with the form he'd established, let's say he'd committed himself to the sonnet form, 14 lines, certain rhyme scheme, etc., and had the germ of a particular idea or life experience, and then began working that out on paper. What he consistently found was that he came up with something utterly remote from anything he had thought about at the beginning of that process. So that was his way of working. He was a poet who, I think, more than almost any other that I know in the 20th century, set himself these very often old-fashioned but highly demanding metrical forms that he was going to commit himself to writing, the sonnet being one. But, for example, Stopping by Woods, which is a poem I mentioned last time, has an incredibly demanding rhyme scheme. By that I mean to say there have to be a lot of words that rhyme exactly with one another, without seeming forced or phony or just put there because they rhyme, etc. And he'd set up these demanding formal requirements and lay across that a kind of flow of thought and feeling with the germ of an experience. And out of that kind of collision of formal discipline with deep affectivity came these wonderful things. Which is to say that in a way, once Frost finishes, he becomes just like the rest of us, a reader. Yes, he was the maker of the poem, but now he with us has to stand back and look at it, and it would probably often be the case if he were here with us, that he would find our seeing things that hadn't occurred to him. Of course, he put them there. It's his poem, after all. But that we can kind of discern a depth that may have he built better than he knew, in other words. because he's working on the one hand with these metrical constraints and on the other hand with his affects and experience and coming up with something totally wonderful and new and surprising. So I guess the answer to that question is, did Frost think of all these things? We don't know. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't, but I think the way to think of ourselves as readers, as he would be once the poem goes into the public domain and he's made it. Yes.
I suspected that's what you would say, and I know of a few other particular incidences where that very thing is true, like for instance Michelangelo's David. Mm-hmm. He said that he actually helped David come out of the marble. He didn't create it, it was there, and he just helped him come out.
Helped it come forth.
And in the Baroque era of musical composition, we think of as this complicated, wonderful music, but the treatises that were written about Baroque music were written after the music had been written. Mm-hmm. So it was like that was the music of the time, the popular music, and they just knew how to do it, and they wrote about it and studied it afterward.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so that's a good.
And that's often the creative process, you drop down into it.
No, that's a good parallel to what. Right. Okay, I think we're ready now that we've had that background for our first test of the day. We are going to put up a sonnet. This is a sonnet which conforms exactly to the rhyme scheme that would have been typical of the Shakespearean sonnet. A, B, A, B, C, D, C, D, E, F, E, F, G, G. That is, ends in a kind of rhymed couplet. I'm going to put it up. I'm going to ask someone to volunteer to read it. And then I'm going to give you 5 minutes to think yourselves or in your groups of three or four. And the question you're going to be asked to think through, you're going to be asked to think through two. One, what's this poem about? And two, to whom is this poem addressed? Okay, is that clear?
Can you move it back a little bigger?
Oops. Is that better?
Yeah.
I think I'll turn the lights out here. Maybe it'll be sharper. Can someone douse the lights and see if that's... How's that? Okay, anybody want to volunteer to read? Yes, please.
No speed of wind or water rushing by, but you have speed far greater. You can climb back up a stream of radiance to the sky, and back through history up the stream of time. And you were given this swiftness, not for haste, nor chiefly that you may go where you will, but in the rush of everything to waste, that you may have the power of standing still, off any still or moving thing you say. Two such as you with such a master speed cannot be parted nor be swept away from one another once you are agreed that life is only life forevermore, together wing to wing and oar to oar.
Thank you. Okay, you have 5 minutes to think through those two questions. What's this poem about? And to whom is it addressed? Okay, can we have someone please with the lights? Thank you. So, anyone for volunteering an initial hypothesis what this poem is about?
About choices.
Choices? What makes you think it's about choices?
Because it said you have this power of master speed, that you have the power of standing still, of going back into time. Up to the sky. It just seems like you have a lot of power within your choice of how you use it. Yes, up to you.
Okay, yes, Pat.
We found it impossible to answer your first question without the help of the second, so we kind of did both at once. And that was, I believe, who was it to or who was it for? And we kind of saw it as potentially as sort of a marriage poem of sorts, but being written to two people who were, forget the who were. We were looking at this swiftness, this hate, this master speed as sort of an ability to be in time and yet beyond time, to be able to see the history, what's happened, what's gone before, sort of a more powerful position than maybe other things in the created order, that not being a speed that's far greater, basically, than the water or the wind, is this power of being able to stand still in the midst of time and look back at what's happened. But then toward the end is where we got this idea of the marriage thing, because the two such as you with such a master speed and agreeing that life is only life if you have
Okay. So you connected the two questions and thought that you couldn't answer one without
the other. Yeah, we had an awful hard time with the first one without the second.
Without the second.
Yeah.
And your point about choices, I think the reason that it is more about power than it is about choice is that the speaker actually denies that the gift of speed has much to do with will. In other words, mm-hmm. It isn't that you don't have this gift to go where you will. Or to be swift, you have it for other things, and he enumerates it. So it seems to me that maybe where you've steered us, it's being addressed to people getting married, you say?
Perhaps.
Okay. And then, can you say succinctly before we turn to others, then what it's about? It's addressed to people getting married, and it's about, you said power, a special power they have?
Well, I don't know that power is the right word. Out here, because I don't remember quite what we were saying, but it sounded good at the time.
Anybody else want to jump in on this line of...
May I?
Yes.
The reason to me that it's metaphysical, I mean, that it does, you know, that it has this ability to be anywhere instantly, is that it's speaking to love, that it's the essence, it's not individuals. And it's about that energy joining with a reciprocal energy. So the love, meaning love, is where wing to wing, or it's a war, so it's the two coming together, loving each other. But it's really spoken to love itself.
Okay, but it's in the neighborhood.
It's
in the same neighborhood of the reading there, in the sense that it has to do with love and couples and so forth. But you want to make the two abstractions. Love is one, and what's the other?
It doesn't have to be romantic love at all. It's just that element of loving, where it isn't instantaneous, it can happen just like that. It can be very still. I mean, that's
okay.
Where I'm picking up.
Yes?
Well, I guess I thought that at first, and then something just said something like inspiration or muse, and it's kind of like about the poet and the muse, and his muse, perhaps. Again, the partnership is one.
Yes.
And I've been looking at master, you know, thinking the titles are often windows, and maybe there's the religious element of it, that there's, because it talks of a master and it's a gift, and you were given this. It's not something you achieve, it was given to you. And that two such as you with this cannot be part of an already swept away from one another once you've agreed. But it's been a gift. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of leaned me toward, I guess, the master to me almost as God.
Okay. But that puts it, that doesn't deny that it could still be some kind of sacred ritual involving two, that is a marriage or something.
Yeah, there is an agreement there.
With the... from one another once you are agreed. Yes.
I'm struck with all the images of rushing, wind, water, speed, you know, streams,
fish.
Swiftness, no, and then down to wing to wing, and the whole view of nature, the world as rushing off to waste, but that you, there's something about you that can step apart from that and stand still. And that would seem to only be the human being, with that power to of standing aside and being transcendent and looking at a star and tracing the light back up to the light years, or thinking about histories. And if there were two human beings who knew this about ourselves, who would join themselves together, both as natural beings, wing to wing, and as those who can transcend more the world with their technology, that they would, that would be a human union of great power for them, for life ever, forevermore. So in that sense, a marriage, something about the human condition and about a marriage bond.
There's this metaphor too about we enter the ark 2x2 with the idea of, as I understand it, being that we achieve heaven by healing our relationships, and like the forgiveness, for instance.
Well, we're in the neighborhood, I think, of love, marriage, a sacred and transcendent, perhaps, benediction on unions. Let me ask a very concrete question. Together, wing to wing, and oar to oar, what actually, in a quite literal sense, is the picture that comes to your mind with wing to wing?
Sailboat,
what?
Birds. Eagles.
Eagles. Now, do you picture, those who picture the birds, as do you picture wing to wing meaning two separate birds with one's wing touching the other wing, or do you picture a bird, wing here, and it's wing to wing? Joan?
Well, but one bird, two wings, especially the oar one does that. One oar on each side, one rower usually with two oars. They're not paddles, but these are oars.
So you wouldn't picture the oar one to be two boats with an oar touching another boat's oar. So it's insofar as you think wing to wing and oar to oar are parallel, what in effect you think then is that you have two wings on one bird, just like two oars in one rowboat. You're skeptical, then.
I can see it both ways. In fact, I may be strange, but I saw the oar to oar as two different boats to begin with, and I still see it that way. But I have been uncomfortable since the beginning with my idea that it was about two people at all, or even people. But I do like to consider the fact that it might just be one person, or even more of a sort of general, you, the human race kind of thing, as opposed to just two people. That seems way too specific. But I thought of two oars. I guess I'm just not a separate person.
You thought of two oars.
I thought of two oars separate boats. Because I think, not because so much of that, but because I had read the wing to wing the other way, but with two birds, and then I had to see it parallel, or,
And it says from one another, so it indicates two of something.
Right. It cannot be part of something.
Well, surely you're the one who brought up marriage, aren't you? Surely if it's marriage, there is a lot of vocabulary in marriage about the twain or one. I mean, it doesn't necessarily exclude it being about two to see that the two wings join and it's still about two, but they become one there in the last, just like the two oars are two, but pulled together. And in fact, that's the same word at the beginning of the line, together. I'm struck, yes, ma'am.
I was just going to say, it struck me as a commentary on the fact that each of us has the capability of standing still in our lives and looking at ourselves, looking at our whole being, and welcoming that part of ourselves which needs time, decision, and what can welcome the darkness in our life, as it were, the shadow side, so that we can get ourselves together. And that which we would have rejected about ourselves, we can begin to welcome as
another aspect of what helps us to have darkness and light balance, the yin and the yang, the process of welcoming that which we would reject in ourselves as a balance that gives us that greater vision of being one with all of creation, with all of others, and so being able to fly through life knowing we're all connected and that this is forevermore.
Good. Thank you.
You know, as the woman over here spoke about it being maybe perhaps a commentary on humanity, I thought of it along the line of Chardin's idea, the evolution of the universe and human beings perhaps being the consciousness of the universe. We are the universe being conscious of itself, and that our ultimate sort of purpose in the universe, so to speak, is to promote communion or relationship, if we could put it that way. And I guess I get that from the thing about, you know, as if you think of it as humanity, that we're the part of humanity that can, in an instant, with the speed of light, thought, and wish, and so on, you know, you can climb back up a stream of radiance to the sky and back through history over the stream of time. But the idea of evolution includes human history, not just the physical universe. So I kind of picked up on that too. But I think to me the richness of this poem is that it can be understood in many different forms of sort of relationships or dualities and whatever coming together.
Yes, it has such a field of energy. It seems to me that a number of these observations can be confluent in a way. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. I have a question for the group, because I don't understand one line here at
yes.
all. And I just sort of glossed over it.
I want
to see what people think. Yeah. Often he's still or moving
yes.
what you say. Does anybody
you know,
have
yeah,
any?
To me, that was beginning to seem the key to it. I started off with the hunch that this was about the power of thought and the ability to, or imagination to, climb up the stream of radiance in the sky, go through history to time. And then that struck me off any still or moving thing you say, and the image for me began to shift to one of actually writing a poem such mm-hmm. as this. Maybe it was Shakespeare that tipped me off to that, who wrote so many sonnets about you write it down, it's going to last forever. And in putting something, distilling it into a poem, whether it's the radiance of the sky or history or whatever that you distill into a poem, you have the power of standing still, I mean, and keeping it, and you can come back and back to that very same thing again. It's not rushing to waste, but there it is, of any still or moving thing you say. I mean, it was suddenly say that, you know, you could have said of any still or moving thing you want, of any still or moving thing you like. What do you say? Of any still or moving thing you say. And so that this poem is somehow about expression was working its way through me. I guess that's enough to say.
I have a question about that, though, because we kind of had the same idea, but then I came off of the two such as you. Which two are you talking about?
That's the thing that's not completely solved. I had a couple of temporary hypotheses.
Right, we were thinking of thought and everything too, and I came to that line.
But I was thinking of writer and his
the written thing.
And his inspiration or imagination or expression, the two, you know.
You know,
another thing I thought of when I thought of that was how some things that I've read, I've been struck with such recognition. Oh, that's exactly how I see it. This person sees life the same way. And there were two of us who were suddenly one together, or this person helping me navigate my way through my life.
Well, I'll tell you, this group is very astute. I think you identified exactly the line that is the key to unwrapping the poem. And I have to confess that I, having chosen to talk about this, until about 10 minutes before class, I spent most of the day on our hike trying to figure out what in the world this line meant. And you know what broke it for me? I'll tell you what my hypothesis did, especially since it's even set off with this strange dash. What in the world is the dash?
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what I think. My hypothesis is not any better or worse than any that have been offered. I think that this represents a whole shift in what we've been led to think up to here has to do with motion and rest. I think we get the great favorite pun of Keats now, still means quiet, and moving means emotionally powerful. That was a very moving thing to say. Because what these people are going to do is to agree to something, and they're going to say it to one another in their agreeing, that is to remain together, and they're going to say it in a very quiet and moving way. So in other words, the whole valence to still and moving now shifts from one of motion and rest to one of quiet and emotional sincerity, because it is, to get to your notion, a kind of wedding vow. Forevermore is a kind of tip-off to me because it's in the kind of vocabulary from henceforth and even forevermore. It has a kind of religious resonance to me. But anyway, if they have to agree to be with one another, I think that it may have to do with how they speak that promise. But the other thing I wanted to point out, I'm going to get another poem up here, so that's why I'm rushing. I like the way the first line and the last line, we have wind mastered by wings, water with oars, and if you go through the whole poem, you'll see how the, for example, the next thing, climbing back up a stream of radiance, you have sky or air, wings. For a long time, I had trouble figuring out, and back through history, I mean, that's a stream of history, that's not a stream of water, but this back is what connected to the oars for me, because it's the one thing when you have your back toward the place that you're going. I mean, when you're going this way, you're backing up. So it seems to me that he's worked out very craftily this wing-wing oar-oar business to connect up with the motion-rest stuff. And it seems to me that this stuff following the dash, to such as you with such a master speed, cannot be parted nor be swept away from one another once you are agreed. I mean, in other words, for all that it's a gift, as you said, and for all that it does have this religious resonance for that reason, there's still a kind of agreement or pledge or promise involved here. And I think that this line might be, since it has to do with something they say, a characterization of the manner in which, in a wedding ceremony, they would say it in a very still and moving way. So that's my hypothesis. But let's try one more poem. We still have time. And this one has got to be shorter. So I picked one. I promised I'd do sonnets, but I was asked by the program director to try to connect up with the fact that today is the Hiroshima anniversary, and I thought, what Frost poem could I get for that? And see what you think of my choice.
Fire in a Sunset. Yes.
Fire in a
Sunset. Okay. So let's just take about, who wants to volunteer to read this? Yes.
Fire in a Sunset. Some say the world will end in fire, some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. But if I had to perish twice, I think I know enough of hate to say that for destruction, ice is also great and would suffice.
Good. Okay. What's this poem about? Take a couple minutes to think about it.
Is it a typo or is it supposed to be, but if it, or is
it's
it
supposed to be it?
It is supposed to be it.
The world.
It's
about this.
Well, is that how the poem works, do you think? Equating the ice with, how did you put it, ice with desire?
No, I was equating fire with anger and hatred, and ice with indifference.
The way that I heard it initially, not to discount this at all, but the way that I heard it initially was that there's a fire of desire that would definitely, I mean, he's got no doubt that the fire of desire could destroy the world, but you know, that the icy hate thing, that could do it too. You know, I see those as being just the two really major ways in which the world, I don't know that it's necessarily not the world ending either, but I don't know if that's a separate issue.
To me, there's a passion. Desire is passion, and so is hate. It's like the positive and the negative of the same emotion. I have a question. The line to me that's confusing this one is, but if I had to perish twice?
It
had to perish twice. I was reading it wrong. But still, why does twice apply to the ice and only, what, assumed once for desire? That is a mystery.
Well, he's saying that he favors the theory that fire and desire would be the way to go in. He favors that. But if there were a second perishing, that ice would be...
How could it perish twice?
Good question. I don't know that it's about the world ending.
Well, it kind of reminds me of, like, Eliot, you know, not with a bang, but a whimper, kind of, that he's saying that he'd almost prefer it to end in fire and end in this, like, great big explosion, but it's worse and even scarier for it to kind of just fade away and end without anybody doing anything about it. And that, I mean, ice is, you know, just, like, you know, being empty and being hollow and becoming nothing, you know, and just freezing, slowly freezing over rather than it being like bang, you know? Like when it's really quick and like explosion stuff, it almost seems like there's a way you can stop it, but it's like, you know how when something freezes, it freezes slowly and deeper and deeper and deeper until it's finally all frozen and like, you know, you don't notice it at first. It's even more scary.
So from what all of you have said, I think the surprise of the poem is that the first two lines seem that they're going to engage us in one of these questions about geology. Is it going to be a glacial period that ends the world, a kind of return of super cooling, ozone burning through, et cetera? Or is there going to be fire? We tend to think after the first two lines it's going to be a speculation about cosmology. But it turns out then, as you have all remarked, even the differences among you, that the fire lines up with human passion or longing or appetite, get more and more, or with human hatred. So then it becomes a question about human beings ending the world, either through, as one of you observed, he seems to think it more likely, favor here is an interesting word, does it mean favor as prefer a hypothesis, think more likely, or favor as in I actively want, etc. So we can return to that, but just for I'm going to see what we agree to. We seem to agree that the striking thing about the poem is to suddenly shift it from a cosmological question with natural forces to very human forces like desire and hate. And I guess, Cato, you were suggesting that favor ought to be read here as he would really hope that it would end out of people's longing.
Well, I don't think he hopes that it would. Well, I mean, yeah, I guess that, I mean, we picture that as being really awful and stuff, and hate and those passions and stuff are awful, but that we would be even worse if we lost all those feelings.
Okay, let's hear more about this. Use of the word favor and whether he says that the world has to end once he actually hopes it'll end this way, or is he simply stating favor in the way of preferring the hypothesis? Yes.
Well, I didn't take it that way at all. I see the whole poem as being almost bitter or not a sarcastic commentary on what perhaps he's seeing of the hatred in the world. I don't see it as a prediction or even a choice reference at all about fire or ice. I see the ice part maybe more as, you know, the fire of hatred in the world is so great that the part about the ice is more of a destruction. I mean, a sarcastic, bitter commentary on the fire of hatred in the world, not an actual choice statement or an actual favor statement. More a kind of irony, I think, is what I see.
So you connect fire with hate, then? Yes.
And she's kind of leading into where I was going, putting words to it that I couldn't, which is to say, I didn't necessarily think that it was about the world ending at all. And I think that you put the words to it that I was looking for, that it's more of a commentary about this destructive nature in the world, in the time while we're still in time, of desire and hate and perhaps indifference in the thing by the ice.
Yes.
What strikes me is the last words, the vice. I know it rhymes with ice, but it it seems sort of a strange word, but then when you hear comments and yours, that would fit in.
Can you draw that out a little bit, how it would fit in?
Well, the world can't be destroyed twice, and suffice is a... to me, it's an irony. It fits in with irony because when you're talking about total destruction of the earth, if you were doing it in that literal sense, suffice wouldn't be the right word. It's
something that suffices is like, well, it's enough to do the job, so to speak, but it isn't satisfying or fulfilling. It's just, well, that'll suffice, you know, you say to somebody, but it doesn't mean it's really good enough. It'll just sort of make do.
It strikes me that in many poems that are more obvious than this, that and philosophies, that what we need to do here on Earth is forgive. That's the major thing we have to do in life. That we come to love everything and everyone. And then there is another more meditative and more Eastern idea that is that we desire nothing. That we have. That is what stirs us up, that we want what we don't have, and we have to have something. They both seem to me to take us off center. One is just the bipolar. Back to the polarity again. I think what he's saying here, we have to stop doing both, or we destroy ourselves, really, spiritually, communally, individually. And there was a poem I read by Kabir or Lao Tzu in a book recently that talked about judging either way, saying something is good or saying something is bad. Like, what we desire is good, and what we judge is bad. You know, there are certain things that we've decided that are bad, and we've decided that we can have the knowledge of good and evil, even though God told us that that's an illusion, that it isn't, we do not have that capability. That it's all good. That's, and then you get to the point where you don't judge it at all. It just is.
What would you say in response to what he just said and what others have said about the tone of the poem? You had mentioned you thought it was bitter. That his attitude toward what he's writing about here is one of kind of bitterness.
Or at least irony.
Bitter irony. Yes.
Well, the thing that comes through to me in terms of tone is the issue of the end of the world, which he speaks to three times. And there's an escalation and intensifying of each one of them. First it ends, and then it, the next time it comes up is perish, which is an intensification of the word end. Mm-hmm. The third time it's the kind of the ultimate word, the ultimate intensification, that is destruction. All of those are the same in that they are ultimate and final and complete. But the real issue, the tone, is pressing us to deal with the issue of desire versus hate. And what's striking to both of those, to me, is that neither one of those are kind of requited. They are by their nature sort of unresolved. Desire is, say, the positive end of loving that's not finished. And hate is also not killing or not destruction. In short, it's wanting that, perhaps. And it seems to me the tone is sort of escalation, so that we are being called to a choice, being called to some kind of choice.
So the tone is one of alarm and urgency.
Yeah, some sort of intensifying.
A summons.
Yeah, a summons. Okay.
Yeah, and he's not doing anything. I mean, he holds with those. He doesn't agree with them. He's kind of standing off with them. And he thinks he knows about hate. He's not sure about anything. And he's standing in between desire and hate, and he's experienced a little bit of both. And maybe it's that indecision that's the destructive thing. And that he's not really living life. He's tasting desire, and he thinks he knows about this. And he's just kind of floating in between, and that balance of this poem really struck me. He tastes desire, which makes it a really emotional thing, whereas he knows of hate, which makes it an intellectual thing. And it's that balance between the two, and he's floating in between there. Maybe that's what he's saying is going to destroy.
And intellectuality goes with the whole notion of more icy and sufficing. I mean, in other words, it's a more abstract and cold thing. So your suggestion is that maybe the speaker is part of the very problem he's alerting the readers to, given his own equivocation and standoffishness here. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the some say can support that even further, kind of, well, this is hearsay, I'm recording it, as if it's not taking as seriously as it needs to be taken.
So that we have the ingenious construction of a speaker who's part of the very problem, that is, us drifting into catastrophe because of his own standoff. Some say this, some say that, I've tasted this, I think I know that, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a kind of a lack of engagement, but the word choice, as you pointed out, the escalation from end to perish to destruction is a kind of summons. It has a kind of an urgency to make us part of the solution rather than part of the problem, as the speaker is part of the problem, which is a kind of a wonderful way to wind up not only our sessions about Frost, but also the occasion of this day and what we remember on this day, that particular fire, and the fact that we can't afford simply to stand back and ruminate about it abstractly. Some say we had to drop it, some say we didn't, and get into theoretical things, but to become part of the solution rather than to, as this speaker is, be simply part of the problem. So those, I think, are very astute and helpful readings, and it's just about time now for the bell to ring, so thank you all. Thank you.